Today on The Grave Talks, From Hell to High Water, a conversation with Jerry Pauley. Sometimes light can come from the dark. Sometimes if we just give ourselves, our souls, some help from others who care about us, we're able to get through even the most trying of hours. Jerry Pauley is one such individual who has been to hell and has found high water. As host of the podcast Hillbilly Horror Stories, Jerry is now able to share his life experiences with others in hopes of helping them through dark times while injecting humor and stories of the supernatural. Today, we talk with Jerry about his life's journey as outlined in his new book, From Hell to High Water, on The Grave Talks.
You know, there was always an interest there because I can remember being, you know, 10, 11 years old when the movie Halloween came out and reading the book The Exorcist when I was like 10. And the movie had already been out for 4 or 5 years by the time I actually read the book. So I've always had an interest. But my first experiences with the paranormal came when I was 13, 14 years old. We moved into a house out in the suburbs. We'd always lived downtown at that point in Louisville, Kentucky. We moved out to the suburbs. And we lived in the house for about a year with really nothing happening. And my mother lost a grandparent who she was extremely close to. This was the man who raised her. So that was a father for all intent and purposes. And she went into a heavy state of depression. And from that point on, you can maybe call it poltergeist activity or something, because that's what triggered everything. We started to have several incidents happen in the house over about a 5-year period.
Prior to this happening, what was your outlook, your interest, your even awareness of the idea of ghosts or paranormal?
Well, you know, I don't think I really had an opinion on the paranormal per se. I like scary movies.
Sure.
But I think that's all that I thought it was. I didn't really fathom that there was actually a realm out there where these things actually existed.
So it was very much, this is, you know, it's part of Hollywood. They make for good stories, but probably not real. It wasn't something that was brought up to you up until the age of 13 as, yeah, these things are out there. They exist. We should respect them or anything like that. It just was one of those things like most households that don't dive deep into it. It was just, you know, spooky movies and whatnot. So what were some of the things that you specifically remember? What were some of those first signs after your mother lost this father figure that were poltergeist activity that kind of made people, you know, turn their head a little bit and go, what's that all about?
Well, the very first thing that happened, you know, we're a year into this. And like I said, I didn't know what depression was at the time. I was, you know, just starting my teen years.
Sure.
And things were looked at differently 35 years ago.
Of course.
Your expression for somebody being depressed, or your reaction, I should say, well, back then was typically, you know, just cheer up, yeah, you know, do something that makes it fun. And we know now, you know, 30 some years later, that that's not necessarily how things work when it comes to depression and mental illness. And my mother was doing everything she could to try to, I guess, get through this rough patch that she was having. And she was on the phone with the 700 Club. I remember it like it was yesterday. And she was on the phone. They had a prayer line and it was on playing on television. She's on the phone. I'm sitting next to her. Now we're sitting next to each other. She's on a couch. I'm on a chair, but we're, you know, within an end table from each other. Straight across the room was an old console TV. As you remember these things, they weigh about 6,000 pounds.
Yeah.
And on top of this, I'll describe this because most people don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But on top of this TV, there was a small, what I would call a chair. It was in the shape of a chair. It was actually a pin cushion. And where the seat would be, it would lift up and you could put all of your sewing tools in there, you know, your thimbles and your sewing, your thread and all that stuff. And then the rest of it was a pin cushion. So it's not very big. It's, you know, so it would fit in one hand, no problem. But it's sitting on top of this television. We had just done some painting to the outside of the house. So we had taken off our house numbers. So there was 3 house numbers that were made of metal sitting on top of it and a bottle of Elmer's glue. So it's pretty weighted down for what it was. And we're sitting there as she's on the phone talking to someone and I'm doing some drawing in a sketch pad. This thing pops up about 2 feet in the air and lands in the middle of the floor, which was about 4 feet away from the television. It didn't fall over, Tony. Mm-hmm. That would have made sense.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some vibrations. It popped up in the air and landed in the middle of the floor. And that was the first experience that we ever had. And my mother and I just looked at each other instantly like, you know, did you just see that? And we both agreed just through our looks. Yes, we both saw that. And she immediately told the people on the phone that she needed to go. And we didn't do a lot of discussing. I know we got up and picked the stuff up, but it was a very eerie silence of us both knowing we just experienced something unique.
What was going through your mind at the time?
You know, confusion, yeah. I think more than anything else, because I was very studious back at that point, and I just a big, you know, it has to be something, some kind of explanation,
yeah,
of, you know, but I kept going replaying it in my head. This thing popped up in the air. Nothing would have made it pop up in the air, you know, so I couldn't find that.
Yeah. But you were still searching for it as anyone would when they're having an experience like that for the first time. That obviously wasn't the only thing that would have occurred to continue this forward. How did things progress from there that continued to really baffle you and your family, wondering what's going on here?
It progressed pretty rapidly, to be honest with you. I went to bed at around 11 o'clock that night. I want to say that happened around 8, mm-hmm. 8 p.m. And I went to bed around 11 o'clock, and shortly after I went to bed, my mom came into the room and said, "Hey, I'm hearing some noises upstairs in the attic. Can you come sit up with me?" And you got to know, Tony, my mother is not somebody who's easily scared. She grew up with families that were partially Native American on one side of her family. They believed in a lot of stuff and shamans and that type of thing. And she grew up around that sort of stuff. And, she had always said that she had seen a ghost when she was 7 years old during an appendicitis attack, where she got rushed to the hospital and things like that. So this was something that was in her wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. She just didn't talk about it much. So she wasn't scared easily, but this scared her, whatever it was. And I went in the living room with her and I sat down for probably 15 minutes and I didn't hear anything. She didn't hear anything at that point. So at that point, you know, we don't know what else to do. I went back to bed. But the following night, she came and woke me up again, and I probably wouldn't in there 30, 45 seconds. And we could start to hear things up in the attic. Now, our attic up there, Tony, was not an attic where we stored things. There was a couple of boxes up there, but for the most part, there was no flooring. It was just the rafters and some insulation. Mm-hmm. The noises we were hearing weren't little noises. It sounded as if you took a full-size bedroom dresser and scooted it across a wooden floor. You know that sound that wood makes when it's on wood scooting?
Sure.
That's what it sounded like. And it went on for 10 or 15 minutes back and forth. My father checked it out the next day. Like I said, there was nothing up there that could have caused that noise. And there wasn't any sign of rodents or raccoons, anything like that, which was the obvious thing to check out. So within 2 nights, we had, you know, she had 3 occurrences. I had 2. Just in a 2-night period. It didn't keep at that level. It would eventually taper off, but eventually it would turn into, we heard a baby cry in the hallway of the house at one mm-hmm. point in time. We've had objects that would move around. Like one instance, I was in my bedroom. I went through a door. The house is almost made into a circle. So every door leads into a different room. So, you know, it's one way in and the other way just goes to a different room. And I left and the door was open to my sister's room. So I get up, there was a couple of toys laying right there next to a toy box, but they were in the doorway in my walking path. I pick them up, put them back in the toy box. I'm the only one in the house. Everybody else is out at our pool. I go out to the pool. I spend probably 4 or 5 minutes just, you know, catching up, seeing what's going on. I go back in the house and those exact same toys are right back in the floor again. So those were the kind of things that were regular happenses. Didn't really scare me. But you got used to it. Mm-hmm. And it's, matter of fact, one of the chapters in the book is learning to live with ghosts, because that's what we did over the period. We got to where we just found ways to exist.
What was the point in which, and it may be different for everybody, I don't know, you could answer that, but where it made you personally, Jerry, say, okay, I think the house is haunted, and you just kind of had run out of explanations. I know you kind of learned to live with it, but what was the point? Was there a specific event? I mean, the baby crying or something of that nature where you just had to say, it's haunted. I don't have an explanation, but I at least know we're going down that path.
I think where it happened for me, Tony, is in my bedroom, which was in the very back of the house, I could lay in bed and I could hear whispering coming from the ductwork. Now, this is probably within 2 months of the first events happening. And as I laid in bed with no noise at all in the room, I could hear voices coming from the ductwork. It sounded plain as could be that it was two men and a woman, but I could, it was more of a whisper. I could tell the voices, but I couldn't understand anything that was ever being said. And at that point, I worked some odd jobs, did some babysitting, that stuff like that, and went to Kmart and I bought me a little small stereo that I could sit right next to my bed. And literally, if I rolled over, I would have rolled into the stereo because I wanted it to be close enough to where I could always turn it on and drown out those noises. So it didn't take long, probably a couple months before I realized something was up.
How was your mother coping with these things as they continued to torment her as well? What were some of the tactics that she was using to keep peace?
You know, we didn't talk a whole lot, as odd as it sounds. We were really close back then, but we didn't talk a whole lot about what was going on in the house. We both knew there were things going on in the house, but it wasn't something where we had a conversation like you and I are having right now.
Yeah.
As to what's causing it. Her depression got worse and worse. She eventually got to the point where she was having some severe medical problems that I feel like were brought on more mentally than physically, because, mm-hmm. you know, you can do a lot of things to your body if your mind tells it to do something.
Sure.
She got to the point where she developed something called esophagitis, to where the acid was coming up in her throat to the point to where it was so raw, she couldn't eat solid foods. She had to go on a baby food diet and soft foods like mashed potatoes. So this changed her whole outlook. She used to be very outgoing and we'd just get up and go on trips spur of the moment. And she loved to drive and be out in the car and all that went away. She went to where she never wanted to go anywhere. And she developed these major medical problems. So I don't think she was coping with it very, very well at all. I think it just sent her into deeper depression.
When you look back on this retrospectively and you have, you know, the loss of this figure in her life that sent her to the depression initially and her trying to cope with it. And then also these events coming up. Naturally, you know, as you know, and from doing your own show, the first assumption everybody makes is if someone dies and then you suddenly have ghostly activity, it must be that person. I'm certainly not leaning in that direction from everything you're telling me, because it sounds like it was almost trying to torment or taunt or get under your guys' skin. What do you think it was that was going on in your house after this individual died? Something that was trying to you know, exploit your mother's weaknesses of being in that depressive state at that moment in time? Do you think it had anything to do with the individual who had passed on? What are your thoughts on all that?
You know, it's an interesting question, Tony, and I've thought about it over the last 35 years, basically. And, you know, to add insult to injury, after he passed away, her grandmother, which was the other maternal figure in her life, mm-hmm. She passed away 4 months after he passed away. So within 4 months, she lost both of them.
Yeah, it's like a double whammy.
That was really, like I said, insult to injury on that point. You know, and I'm with you with initially that would probably be the thought. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what she thought. But this, even though it wasn't, I would say, a malevolent spirit, mm-hmm. it just didn't come across as somebody who just wanted to get a message to her either.
Yeah.
And we eventually got to the point. We had we were Catholic at the time. We had a priest come over, the neighborhood priest, do some blessings on the house. He didn't really like the way it felt either. He just felt like there was just an energy that was off. He never would really say negative or malevolent or anything like that. He just said just something didn't seem right. But whatever he did didn't work. And she eventually got a hold of somebody, and I don't know all the details, because like I said, I was only like 15 at the time, but she eventually got a hold of somebody that hooked her up with some parapsychologists out of the University of Louisville. They came out. We didn't tell them anything about what was going on other than we were having activity. They sat down in one of the bedrooms. They chose a room to go to, and they went to that room. They sat. We all sat down on the floor, almost, you know, Native American style. Mm-hmm. They lit a candle in the middle of us, and then they just started, one of the mediums started trying to make contact, kind of went like in a trance type state. Wouldn't like I've seen on TV or something like that. It wasn't quite as extravagant as that. But when it was all said and done, we weren't really hearing anything. It's like she was doing all the talking mentally. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really know what was going on. But when it was all said and done, they said that it went back to the pioneer days. It was more our property rather than the house. Mm-hmm. They said that there was this gentleman's daughter became pregnant out of wedlock. The baby was born illegitimately. And he, though, I guess, feeling like she was an embarrassment to the family, he killed her, the baby, and the gentleman that was the baby's father. And they were buried on the property, but the crime took place on the property as well. And they thought that that was the problem. Mm-hmm. Now, we hadn't told them about the baby crying or any of that. So that did kind of seem to answer that.
Yeah.
And where they said that some of the people were buried were the problems of the house where we had the most issues. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. They seemed to feel like that it wasn't anything to do with a relative. Of course, you know, that's all up for interpretation, I guess you could say.
Sure.
When I look back now and I think about poltergeist activity, I know a lot of times that's usually children, young adults that are going through adolescence that kind of can bring that on mentally. And I'm kind of wondering, since we lived in the house for a year without any kind of incidents and it all started at this time, if maybe this very traumatic time in my mother's life had caused her to maybe create most of these things mentally. And that's kind of what I lean towards today.
That's interesting. Almost like someone haunting themselves with their own energy.
Correct.
It's a reoccurring thing this year. It is. I mean, it's odd after doing, you know, our program for so many years. I haven't heard so many times this idea pop up than in the last, you know, 365 days of an individual being able to make these sort of things manifest themselves without some sort of outside intervention. So when you think of it that way, and is it that she's really doing this all on her own? Obviously not intentionally. She's not sitting there willing a baby to cry or the threads to go up off the television and fly forward. But is there something else involved, do you believe, where she's expelling this energy and then something else is using it to do it? Or is it all within, not her control, but within her sphere of energy that is affecting these sort of things and pulling these things out of the air and out of the atmosphere, that maybe from the past where you have the baby crying and things like that, and it's essentially giving it an amplifier to hear? Or is there something else, do you think, that grabs on to that sorrow, that energy that she's expelling, and then uses it in whatever direction it pleases?
Until recently, that's really where I was leaning towards. Mm-hmm. I really felt like that, you know, you hear a lot of people, whether it's demons or malevolent spirits or however you want to term it, that they really like to feed off of people's emotions, especially if they're down and out. They like to kind of just gravitate towards the people who are the weakest. And at the time that somebody's really suffering, especially from depression, they are the weakest.
Sure.
And so that's what I've always thought. And then just, I don't know, something clicked to me here in the last year and a half. And I thought maybe, just maybe, she was causing this herself, like you said, unbeknownst to her.
Yeah.
But you know, so, but it very well could be a combination of the two.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've heard so many stories in the last year or so where it's, I don't want to say astral projection, but because I think sometimes that almost implies like I'm trying to do this, but where it's like somebody almost in a dreamlike state or things of that nature, and they're actually somewhere else. Sometimes they're seen, sometimes they're not, but they can back it up with what they witnessed outside of their body somewhere. And, you know, influenced the environment around them. And it's just, it's such a fascinating thing where how many of our hauntings are really done by the living and not the dead that we are really completely unaware of. How did this continue on? Was there ever any sort of resolution to this with your family and this house?
Honestly, it tapered off at times and it would come back a little stronger at times. But for the most part, what I've told you were just reoccurring things, especially the hearing the voices, the sounds in the attic. Those things just continued on for the course of about 5 years. But sometimes there'd be 2-3 months where there'd be basically nothing. And then, you know, it would be a couple of days where everything was just back and then would go down. But eventually over about a 5 year period, it just stopped. And, you know, I talked to my sister when I first started writing the book. And she was telling me, you know, hey, there's some stuff that happens. Now, my dad still lives there. We moved in that house in 1981, and he still lives there. My mother passed away back in 2010. And, you know, there's been some, I took a young lady that I was dating over there several years ago. She was a medium. It was actually on my birthday, the first birthday after my mom's passing. And she seems to think that my mom was in that house at that time. And, you know, so, I mean, who knows what's going on? And maybe now that my, you know, if my mom is still there, which I have no way of knowing that, but if she is, you know, maybe she makes sure that there's nothing bad at that house.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it's really all up for interpretation again.
Did the activity coincide with your mother? Was her health improving? Was her depression symptoms improving over the course of those 5 years? Was she getting better?
No, not really.
No,
okay. I don't think my mom ever got better. There, she had times where she was a little better, but for the most part, even though my mom physically passed away in 2010, you know, realistically, the mom that I knew up to that point passed away back in 1982.
Okay. Okay. Obviously, where I was curious about was if there was improvement, if that slowed down the activity. But that's interesting that it did not. So continuing on, you had all these experiences in your childhood and growing up and dealing and trying to understand, you know, as a child, you know, what depression even is and discussed in a very different way, shape and form in the 1980s as it is today. As you then grew into a young adult, how did life progress for you in terms of your relationship with understanding all of that and understanding who you are and these experiences that you had that if you shared them aloud to, you know, a large percent of the population, they're going to look at you like you're crazy, but you knew, you know, you had them. What was the next chapter in your life as you grew up?
You know, it's funny, Tony, because you're 100% on there. You know, I didn't share that information with a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, we dealt with it on our own. And one of the things that I guess I had never really paid attention to, but when you look back, it kind of all fits together, is my mother and I had a very special bond. And, you know, I've done research on this since then. And a lot of times when you have a really special bond, like almost like an ESP type thing between each other, you know, you'll hear it all the time with twins. You know, twins have that special thing. Well, sometimes that's fairly common between a mother and a son. I don't know why mother and son, but that's more times than not where you hear the combination. And we had that. And I can remember one time, this was a story that I love to tell. That gives an example. I was at a friend's house. So me and a friend of mine were at another friend's house. My mother had no clue where I was. This was pre-cell phone days, obviously. This was right around my senior year of high school. So I'm, you know, 16, 17. We're at the house and we're just sitting around on the couch, BS and having fun. And all of a sudden, we hear this loud crash in her laundry room. We go in there and there was no laundry running. So there was no vibrations or anything like that. But they had a big container of laundry detergent that had fell off a shelf and landed onto the top of the washer. So you can imagine the noise that made.
Yeah.
I automatically looked at my buddy, Tim, and I was like, hey, we have to go home. He's like, why? I'm like, trust me, we just have to go home. And I only lived like 5 minutes away. So we get to the house. As soon as I get there, my mom was, you know, in a panic. I've been trying to get a hold of you. I didn't know where you went. Your uncle came over here. He was got sucker punched by a guy up at work. He came here. You know, he got your dad and they both left to go. You know, I guess they were going to go try to find this guy and all this stuff. But that's kind of things that happen on a regular basis that I never knew. She wanted to get a hold of me, and somehow, you know, in this place, this bottle of laundry detergent falls off, and I automatically know that means to go home. Mm-hmm. Most people would say that's a coincidence, but to me, I knew it wasn't a coincidence.
Yeah.
But those things happened a lot. I mean, I remember when I split up with my first real girlfriend, and I get home, and she's waiting for me. She has no clue I split up with my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. But she's waiting for me. And as soon as I walk through the door, she greets me and she's like, is everything okay? Are you all right? She knew. Mm-hmm. And it was just the strangest thing. And I know a lot of parents out there, they kind of know that thing with their kids. Sure. It was just different with my mother and myself. And, you know, those things happened on a regular basis. So
that's interesting, because I was talking the other day with Jen about empathic skills and abilities and things of that nature. And I do not at all consider myself empathic, but I think sometimes people can be empathic to just specific individuals, not necessarily, you know, as a whole, where you're walking around and you can walk through the mall back when we walked through malls. And you know, some people can sense and feel everything from everybody, and it's got to be overwhelming. But I think sometimes certain people, mother, son, I think husband, wife, sometimes and son, child, mother, child, sometimes those bonds can form and can be completely empathic. While we may not have them for other people, you know, we may want them, but sometimes they're just there. It's like sometimes there's just that connection that is there, that knowledge that sometimes, you know, I don't know the other word to put it other than there's a supernatural force sometimes that can play an effect where, for example, the washing machine fluid, you know, falling down and you knowing what that's all about and nobody else does. But something so strong that's there between the two that they just know, and you know, and they know that there's something going on. Is that what you feel like you had with her? A very unique bond that was just between you two with that sort of ability?
Yeah, I do believe that was the thing, you know, because like I could probably, and in the book, I think I named 5 or 6 different instances where she just knew something.
Yeah.
You know, even, you know, I remember one time when I was going to split up with a different girl, and she told me I was getting ready to go over her house, and she said, don't go over the house. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, why don't I go? She said, I'm just telling you for your own good, don't go over there. And, you know, I got mad, and my mother and I had a unique relationship. We argued constantly, and it got worse as years went. And that actually is part of, you know, the problems that I suffered as guilt from that. But, you know, I go over to her house, and that was so random that she just told me not to go. I go over to the house, and I was always told, if, you know, hey, come on in, you don't worry about knocking, just come on in. And I come in, because I knocked a few times and nobody answered. And I walked in, and the girl I was dating was at the sink, the kitchen sink, with her mother. And I guess her mother was washing her hair, so that's why they didn't hear me over the water. So I walk in towards the kitchen area, and I hadn't said anything yet. And I overheard a conversation where basically this girl was getting ready to break up with me. And she was going, had been seeing her old boyfriend. And her mother was telling her, you know, hey, if this is the way you're going to do it, you need to break it off with him because he's a great guy. And, you know, that's just very not the way to do things. And so I heard exactly what my mother didn't want me to hear.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and then when I got back, just to show you our relationship, when I get back to the house, instead of her, you know, like grabbing me and I'm sorry, she was instantly with, I told you so. You know, that was my mom. I mean, that's what caused the problems. We were both hard headed. And even though we had this connection, we both, you know, we just argued constantly. But that was how my mom handled that situation. I told you so.
Sure.
You listen next time.
Sure. So let's jump more in towards the middle of your story and what you write about in the book, where you yourself found yourself in some dark places in life. And I know that that's probably not the easiest thing to talk about, but hey, let's talk about them. and let's talk about, you know, what happened, how you got there, how you dealt with those sort of things, and how, you know, the world of supernatural and ghosts and such also, you know, may have played a role in that part of your life.
Well, Tony, the one thing I'll tell you about the book, it's in three parts, and most of the paranormal stuff is in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But in all the chapters throughout the book, we do keep diving back into paranormal because I've had paranormal experiences my entire life.
Sure.
I just decided to put them in where they went. And
sure.
If it was in the middle part of my life, that's where they went and in the book. But the main part of the middle of the book is focused on the fact that, you know, I got married. I had what I considered to be a dream life. I had three beautiful kids. We talk about how my firstborn completely changed my entire life. And the way I looked at stuff, where I wasn't as selfish. But the reality of it was, sometimes we see ourselves in a way that's not completely accurate. And you don't know until later down the road. You know, the reality of it was, I had a wonderful wife and three wonderful kids. And for the most part, I was a jerk. And a lot of people who listen to Hillbilly Horror Stories today would never have guessed that. And that's why I thought it was important to put this out, because I want people to know that you can change as a person if you really want to.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it took me losing everything that was important to me to even realize that I needed to change. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've got this fantastic marriage going in my mind. And the reality of it is, Tony, I was an abusive husband. Now, I wasn't abusive in a way to where I never laid a hand on my wife. I've never laid a hand on a woman, but you don't have to be abusive.
Sure.
You know, I worked a very stressful job and I didn't know how to cope mm-hmm. with that in the best ways. So when I got home, I was usually grumpy, in a bad mood, and things that really weren't her fault were her fault to me. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way that I saw it. And so a lot of times verbally, I would call names. I would say stuff I didn't mean. And over a period of time, that completely ruined my marriage. Mm-hmm. And eventually she asked for a divorce. And when she asked for the divorce, it hit me like a ton of bricks, because literally in my mind, I thought I had the perfect marriage.
Yeah.
That's how oblivious to the fact I was to the damage that I was doing to the relationship and the type of person I had become. I didn't used to be that person, but I became that person.
Sure.
And I struggled with temper issues, anger issues, obviously. And, you know, it was tough. And then, you know, we were together for 13 years. And when, you know, the woman that you love, that you think, man, it's got this fantastic wedding, I'm living the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a fairy tale. Not to her.
Sure.
And, you know, I was a yeller. I was a screamer. And, you know, when she tells me, hey, it's time to go, she instantly became super cold. My ex-wife was not really good at dealing with her emotions. Mm-hmm. She'd better to write something down than to tell it to you, because she just couldn't. Mm-hmm. And it was tough for her. It took her, apparently, from what she told me, she had fell out of love 2 years prior. That's hard to take when you got the woman you love telling you she just don't love you anymore. And she's fell out of love 2 years ago. So she wants this divorce, and she instantly became so cold, I couldn't touch her. I don't mean touch her like in an intimate way. Mm-hmm. I mean, no hugs, no grab her hand, nothing. Mm-hmm. She got to the point where she finally was going to do it. And this is the only way she knew to do it.
Yeah.
And it completely killed me inside.
Sure.
And I was like, yeah, well, why don't we try canceling? Nope. I could barely get the words out of my mouth. Nope. I don't want to. This, I've made up my mind. And without her even telling me, I knew the problem. So I knew it before. I just didn't focus on it. And we decided, I eventually talked her into us doing some counseling, and we would give it a year. And I was as good as I could possibly be for that year, even though life was not normal for me. I lived on pins and needles every second of my life, scared to death to make a mistake.
Sure.
And, you know, I agreed there would be no intimacy, nothing during the course of this year. And I was completely fine with that because whatever it took. Mm-hmm. The year came and went, and a year to the day, Tony, this is still what I want. You know, I didn't even have to ask her. It was a year to the day, and she did it to look, she's a good enough woman to where she did it to please me. I don't think she ever thought it was going to work out, but I'll give her credit in the fact that she gave it the effort just for me.
Sure.
So at that time, I move out of the house, and now I'm not seeing my kids every single day. It's I've lost the woman that I'm in love with. I was in a business that was commission only, which you can imagine how it is trying to go to work and do sales on a commission only basis when you don't even want to be there.
Sure.
So everything suffered. I literally hit rock bottom. And at that point in time, it was March 18th of 2001. I was coming over in the morning. She went to work very early, too early to get the kids off to school. So I had to come over, wait in the driveway, which was my choice, till she left. I would come in, get the kids ready for work in our old house, or ready for school, get them off, and then I would go to work. Well, I decided on the 18th of March that I didn't want to do this anymore. This was not my life. This is not what I signed up for. I was in intense pain every single day, worst pain I'd ever been in my life. And I just wanted it to be gone. Mm-hmm. So I decided the next morning I was going to get the kids off to school. I was going to write notes to each one of the kids and my ex-wife. And then I was just going to be done. And I was completely at peace with that. So I get over the next morning, get the kids off to school, wrote them a note, put them in a sealed envelope, left them on the kitchen table. I went to the medicine cabinet and I took everything that I could find. Mm-hmm. Prescription pills, Tylenol, you name it. I took probably 150 to 200 pills. Mm-hmm. And then I laid down on the couch, completely happy to just drift away. And as I was getting drowsy, it somehow dawned on me that never did before that my kids got home from school before she got home from work, and they would have been the ones to come in and find me.
Sure.
And I couldn't let that happen. So I made my way to the phone, called 911 and told them the situation. They came. I had the paramedics grab the letters off of the kitchen table. And then they took me to the hospital and pumped my stomach on the way to the hospital and went through the whole treatment and everything that day. But that was as low as it could possibly get for me, was that time of my life.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Jerry Pauley about from hell to high water and his life experiences. In the second half of our conversation, we'll ask Jerry what exactly helped pull him out of very dark places in his life. How did Jerry work to keep the negative out of his life while hosting a show about very dark stories? How does Jerry feel that sharing ghost stories has helped others deal with being in dark places in their own lives? And can ghost stories be an escape from a very dark world? All of that and more in part two of our conversation. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Briski. Thanks for listening.